Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting founder, you know, a founder now turned investor, you know, with his last company. You know, they did quite a lot of good stuff. You know, they raised over $200 million. We're going to be talking about that blend of software and hardware, you know, and some of the other stuff that they're doing now, like how they go about evaluating companies, what to look at, you know, when investing into products, how to think about team structure, you know, whether that is the engineering team or the product development team. And then also thinking about go-to-market, especially when you are at an early stage. So again, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Robert Grazioli. Welcome to the show.
What's up? Stoked to be here.
So born in Brooklyn, but you travel quite a bit. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
Yeah, life was fun. Life was different. Born in Brooklyn when I was five, my parents took us off to Italy. My dad got a job there as a CTO for a bank. So spent some time there. Obviously, my dad being a CTO was around technology a lot, which just like super integral in my life. Moved back to the States, to Virginia, went to high school there. And then eventually off to Syracuse, which is really where my, I think, entrepreneurial journey began. So to speak. So was part of a networking major there, basically how to configure routers and switches, but more importantly left, met my now co-founders there. There are five of us, and started our first company my junior year of college. So,
but that was kind of like a trial and error, you know, you guys were kind of like testing stuff and figuring things out. So how do you land on the idea of density and what kind of like got you guys to think, hey, you know, maybe this one, you know, this idea has some legs?
Yeah. So I think trial and error is an important theme in my life and in my co-founders' journeys. Like we tend to say yes more than no. And I know the advice is always to the contrary, but saying yes to things is sort of how we wound up where we are. So we started a services business out of college. We were just in a small city and we were technical. People needed stuff built. We did pretty well in our first year, and that led us to try to chase a model where any profits from our business we would kind of spend in like an R&D fashion and try to launch products into market. We built a to-do application, which didn't work very well. We built like a hotel maintenance product that we really tried to bring to market. We thought it had legs and didn't. And then we were a bit jaded after our like eighth try of bringing a product to market, thinking maybe we should just focus on building an agency. But one of my co-founders had the idea of counting people in a city with a Wi-Fi router, essentially. So we'd count MAC addresses. And we entered a competition called the Launch Conference. It's with Jason Calacanis, and we won our category and all of a sudden had access to venture capital. And made the tough decision to actually shut down our agency business and go all in on what became Density. So trial and error for sure. That's a great, I think, underlying theme in my life in general.
And what ended up being the business model of Density? You know, how were you guys making money there?
Yeah, so the business model's changed quite a bit. We were really infatuated with this idea of like hardware as a service. So you pay a subscription, you get leased. We were building sensors that counted people in rooms. So you would lease these sensors and really pay for the software. So we were super excited about that. But you know, when you go into market, especially in the enterprise world, you learn very quickly that you tend to need to operate on these businesses' terms. And the people we were selling to were really stuck on like CapEx models and OpEx models. And when they were purchasing hardware, like they wanted that to be part of their CapEx budget. So in the end, we decided to really be selling the hardware and then having software almost sold separately accompanying that hardware. And that was tough. Like that created a lot of friction for us. We were software people, software minded. So learning how to actually run a hardware business and how to focus on optimizing margins across really two different products was a definite challenge. But I think like the biggest challenge was just making that hardware real. As a group of software people, that was kind of an insane journey in and of itself.
So why are startups that are blending in software and hardware so complicated? What's so complicated about it?
Yeah, I think one is the business model. Like I think a lot of people getting into building a company these days are thinking about it like a software product and don't think about the operations involved in building hardware, which is basically like you have all these fixed costs that you end up accruing. And so it's very capital intensive upfront. If you're not used to like planning, which the software world is kind of not, it's very much throw it against the wall, see if it sticks, then you could end up really wasting a lot of time and money and ultimately killing your business. So I think like that idea is one, very hard, but also hardware is challenging to build and test, and you really have to make sure the product works before you're in market. And that's also kind of the antithesis to a lot of software development. And that's something that I think a lot of people struggled with when you had this big IoT wave. When we launched this company, it was kind of 2013-ish. You had a big emergence in IoT-based products. And I think that's where a lot of companies faltered. They had these great ideas, but they just didn't really know how to execute or have the patience to execute well. And we were kind of one of those companies, honestly.
I was thinking too, you know, while you were speaking here, you know, when you build a company like this, the way that you think about the team, especially at an early stage, how you develop that infrastructure in which you're starting to hire engineers or product people, you know, how did you go about that? And what were some of the biggest lessons that you got?
Yeah. I mean, we messed up a lot. I think we invested in a lot of like amazing talent, but they're maybe used to operating at a scale that we were not operating at. So they're maybe X Apple. And so they're used to millions of units and planning a business based on that. Whereas we were really trying to go to market in like a small niche enterprise space. And we don't get the same kind of cost reductions because we're not shipping the same level of volumes. But also on the engineering side, it's the same thing. They don't have the typical time and testing ability that they otherwise would, because we simply don't have the capital to afford that kind of time. So you need people who are more holistic, more systems engineers, more like product-minded people who are really going to help you focus on building the simplest possible thing, so you're not over-engineering a hardware product and even considering more off-the-shelf options versus constantly going custom with your hardware selection. We were delayed months, like six month delay on our production product. In order to get to market, what I wound up doing was taking our prototype and basically extending the number of prototypes we built to the hundreds, and using these early test products to install in customer locations and actually get the kind of product feedback we needed to make the right decisions, both on the software and hardware side. And there were so many learnings from that. Like getting on an enterprise network as an IoT product became a product in itself. And that's just not something we really would have learned had we actually built this production product. Like we would have really messed up had we gone to market at scale if we didn't have those learnings. So finding ways to be lateral, but always be moving forward, I think is where a lot of other hardware companies falter. Like they stay so narrow-minded on that hardware track and don't think about creative ways to at least get their product in the market in small volumes, take those learnings into a bigger run later on. I don't know if that makes a ton of sense, but.
And I was thinking too, you know, on the software meets hardware, one of the things there that I see is that it's extremely challenging raising money from investors. So you guys raised quite a bit. So what was the total amount raised? And then also what were the cycles? How was it like going through those cycles too?
We had some ups and downs. I think early on, there was definitely an excitement around IoT-based products. So I think we were kind of part of that category. Of people, and we were building something that just made sense. Like our pitch was, how many people are in a space before you get there? This was before Google had Google wait times, essentially. So that pitch was really intuitive for people. The story was really intuitive. And my co-founder is also an amazing storyteller. And he's now the CEO of Density. And he was fantastic at just creating a compelling narrative around how obvious this problem was. But as time went on and it became more of an enterprise product, we were in this real estate world now. It definitely started to get a little more challenging. We were mostly buoyed by our ability to get into big name businesses and land early deals and be effective and build solid relationships with those businesses as we were trying to bring product to market. So that kind of carried us. But we were also really lucky to have great investors that I think took big risks, helped us with a bridge round early on that kind of got us really into the pandemic era, which completely changed how people thought about their spaces. People stopped showing up to the office. So as you can imagine, all of a sudden this became like a tier three problem to like a tier one problem. We need to figure out what to do with our office space. And we became pivotal in helping people make those decisions. And that's where we raised off of that momentum for our latest round where we hit that $1.1 billion valuation. And that's kind of carried us to today.
And hey, 1.1 billion people will think, hey, that's unbelievable. They probably read like all the articles that were covering that. And they think that it's like, oh my God, 1.1 yeah. billion, like the Holy Grail. There's probably like other stuff that comes with it too that people don't talk about it much. You know, what could those things be?
Well, of course. Well, one, you have now the pressure of living up to that valuation, which at the time, like valuations were high. So you were able to get those kinds of numbers. We're raising at the top of a bubble, which we learned. So now you have to kind of go after and prove to the world that you're actually worth that amount. That's an incredible amount of pressure and creates like way more emphasis on your go-to-market execution in ways that I think, as a naive founder, like you don't always expect and you're not always prepared for. So you need people in the room who've been there before. And we hired some great, I think, senior people who've kind of seen that. And again, our investors are also really helpful. The other is like your strategy changes too. When you sort of end up with that much cash in the bank, you start to think about your market position differently, especially when you have a downturn in the market. So I think at times like you something that's always really beneficial as a founder is having a survival mindset. So you kind of shift from, okay, how like do we have a corner of the market and how do we make sure like we use this cash really wisely and extend our life for as long as possible until we can get our next pop and our next find our next frontier in the market. So those are some things that were unexpected. And I think too, it's just like just reminding yourself that that's not the end all be all to building a business. Ultimately, the how much you raise doesn't matter. You at some point you want to stop raising capital and you want to be a highly profitable business. And I think we've always had our heads screwed on right in that sense. I definitely see other founders kind of get caught up in that magic, and all of a sudden expenses go through the roof. They're buying, way too much swag essentially, and it turns into a party and not what it really is, which is like you really need to execute now because there's a lot of money on the line.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. There's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So
With that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Well, you were for 8 years here executing and, you know, really pushing through from nothing to, I mean, being able to see this incredible, you know, amount of value that you guys had created. But then eventually, you know, it comes the idea of potentially going to the other side of the table. So how was that transition like? And at what point you were like, you know what, maybe becoming an investor, becoming, you know, more of a VC is my next chapter.
Yeah. So I think for me, it was deeply personal. I mean, 8 years is a long time. And also I was working with my very close friends and founders. So stepping away was a very difficult decision for me. But I was just kind of waking up every day and starting to feel a little unsure of myself in terms of what I wanted to focus on. And it just felt like there was something missing. I mean, at that point, I was functioning as a head of product in a sense. It was still pretty scrappy. So I was still very much tactical in a sense, but the next step was to be less tactical, was to be more of a an executive in the room. And I didn't think I was ready for that. I don't know what it was, but like I wanted to make things again, or at least be part of that early journey where it was so much more about making a thing than kind of optimizing a business model or optimizing an operation. And so I stepped away. I started doing some consulting, really focused purely on early founders. And so I'm a designer and a front-end developer by trade. And so really like design can be pivotal in the early stages of a business. It can really set you apart from other companies, but also just help you think through things in a way that a lot of people aren't. And so being part of those early journeys again just excited me in a way. And lit that spark that I think was missing. But obviously, just doing services, you kind of lack that upside, you lack that buy-in in the outcomes of these founders. And a lot of the people that we work with would go on to raise really awesome rounds after working with us. And why not be a part of that success? And I think I was super resistant, to be perfectly honest. I wasn't stoked about the venture journey in general. I think like watching the bubble happen, some of the valuations that were being thrown around, I don't want that to happen again. I want businesses to be better earlier, and I want like capital to be spent on people that are focused on the right things. And so I started just getting excited about being part of maybe a better way of investing. And haven't really been this excited in a while now.
So what's the investment thesis for Brett? How do you guys think about deploying capital?
Yeah, so we're obviously influenced by, I think, our previous experience. And we have this general thesis we call boring magic. Essentially, one analogy I like to use, I don't know how well this connects with people, but I think about bridges a lot. Like I live in New York, I'm walking along the promenade in Brooklyn Heights, and you see all these bridges just streaming across the East River. And like what a lot of people don't think about in a bridge, you're looking at this beautiful thing, but there's this little piece of equipment that sits between the road and the supports of a bridge called a bridge bearing. And like, I love bridge bearings. These are the most exciting aspects of a bridge, but the average person doesn't think about them. And we at Bread call those types of products, those types of things, boring magic. The everyday things that no one thinks about that really are the foundation of our world and our society. And those are the kinds of things we like to invest in. So thinking about really fundamental problems. And like you think about real estate, like Density was basically a corporate real estate business. And like it's really an important fabric of our society, like where people spend their time. So these kinds of problems really, really excite us. And think about all the boring things like insure tech, what we call death tech. Essentially, we met this amazing founder who's trying to improve the experience after you have someone close to you pass away. Like right now, it's super scattered. You're stressed out. It's a very challenging thing to manage. Let's improve that aspect of our lives. So these types of problems, these types of people who kind of care about the boring things, are really what excite us quite a bit.
So between the partners, you guys have invested in about 10 to 12 companies. How do you guys go about evaluating businesses?
Yeah, I think this is where, one, it's awesome to have multiple partners who are really well-versed in different areas of business, where I'm more focused on the product and their general like go-to-market strategy, how they're thinking about the future of their product. We have deeply technical partners who are really interested in their foundational engineering practices and how they're thinking about engineering. We have a partner who's a lawyer by education, but has been a chief of staff and helped run HR teams. So one, we're super holistic with our evaluation and we're brutally honest on where people need help. So every founder that walks through the door, we give them a report card almost immediately on where we think they're kind of not excelling, but also where they are excelling. And so being able to be really holistic, but also evaluate their product in a way that I think a lot of other investors can't, and really, really focusing on the tactical nature of how they work. So the fact that we're still also kind of in the trenches with them, we get a sense for how they're working as a team, not just how well they can pitch a story. So getting in the room with them, brainstorming ideas, actually getting a sense for how they're thinking about the problem, what their team dynamic is, really to us is pivotal in that sometimes our initial evaluations are wrong. Like great pitch, really compelling founder, but you get in a room with them and their team, you try to solve a problem and you just see the dysfunction all of a sudden. But the inverse is true. Maybe the founder is not so compelling. Their story is not great, but you get in the room and you realize, oh wait, there's kind of a gem here. They have a good core user base. This problem is interesting. And this team loves this problem. This team loves these founders. It can really flip the switch on your investment. Whereas I think a lot of investments often gut-based because founders or investors aren't really in the trenches or kind of getting to the nitty-gritty with founders.
Now, one thing that you just reminded me there is that most VCs, they say that they add value, right? In fact, 90% of them don't. So you've been able to experience what it looks like, you know, when you're an investor that adds value versus not, because you've been a founder before, because you guys have raised a bunch of money for the last company. So what does it mean to have an investor that adds value? And what can the people that are listening now that are thinking about either raising money from the right people that could add that value or from putting their current investors to work, how does that look like when an investor is providing value?
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's very literal. So you come to us and maybe like your brand's a little lackluster. I will literally sit in a room with you for 2 weeks and help reshape your visual identity, help reshape your go-to-market language, like spin up a refined marketing site, and essentially help you relaunch your product if that's what you need. And we can only do that because we have five founders, five former founders, essentially, and we make our model work. Like it's not the time a lot of other VCs can spend at a seed stage or pre-seed stage. And it's time we can, but it's literally doing work for people. We are in code with our founders. We are like helping them hire. We are deploying our hiring playbook that we used for our previous companies to help them interview and bring on top tier talent. It's actual work output. It's real time spent helping build their product if that's what's needed. It's not always what's needed. So sometimes it's more traditional where we're really just doing advisory, helping make introductions to other investors for the next round, or introducing them to former customers or ours or people who might help them land some business. But and we have direct examples of this too. Like one of the companies we worked with is building authentication in on the blockchain. And we were able to work with them, and we didn't invest in them, but this is a company we definitely would have invested in. We're kind of in the middle of closing our fund. And we really helped them gain market share just by building a better demo of their product. So like a small, discrete project that we saw could lead to market opportunity, we designed and built, took to market, and it really helped them kind of complete their demo journey and close close some big deals.
Absolutely. So imagine you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Bread is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah. And I think I mentioned this before, but it's really a world with a little less hype. So like we call ourselves Bread because, again, it's like an unassuming thing in our world, but it's also foundational. I mean, very few people in the world, unless you have like a gluten intolerance, don't eat bread. And it literally keeps societies going when times are tough. So while like people don't go around praising bread every day, maybe if you're super into making bread, you do. Like we think that's a better world where people are less excited about the next big future thing and more interested in how to make the current things we have better. And I'd love a startup world to be more focused on those kinds of things, those kinds of problems. And I'd love a venture environment that that incentivizes those kinds of products in our world. So I think that's maybe a little ambiguous, but that's definitely the kind of world I want to live in and contribute to, if at all, if I can.
So imagine you were to go into a time machine. Mm-hmm. And you were able to go back in time to that moment where you guys were like, you know, just testing things out and figuring things out, you know, with density, you know, let's say back in 2013 or 14. And you had the opportunity of having a chat with your younger self and with your co-founders, and you were able to give them one piece of advice for going at it with the business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Honestly, it'd probably be don't build a product with lasers in it. That's probably my number one. That would be my number one piece of advice for us at the time. Avoid lasers at all costs. No, but I think in all seriousness, the main thing is it's going to take longer than you think. Every single thing I've done has taken way longer than I wanted it to, of course, but learning how to maintain your ambition while having the patience to do something the right way, I think is what I would tell myself back when we were starting. Like that, my journey being 8 years long and still going, I mean, density is still not at its end. I would not have expected that. And I think just, yeah, like be more patient, but still be excited is kind of what I would tell myself.
I love it. So Rob, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Yeah, I mean, you can go to our site. It's bread.works, and just reach out. Our email address is on there. You could also find me on LinkedIn, Robert Grazioli. My dad is also Robert Grazioli, so you may see him as well. But that's a good way to get in touch with me as well. And really just love meeting founders or other investors and hearing what they're up to. It's kind of the best parts of my day is when I get to meet new people or designers. I'm a designer. It still consumes a lot of my time. So if you're a designer out there, hit me up.
Amazing. Well, hey, Rob, well, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Alejandro, it's been super fun. Thank you.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.